Imagine a world without humans. The humans are all gone, wiped out by a global epidemic. Or the rapture, if you prefer. How does the Earth reclaim itself from human civilization? That's the question at the heart of Alan Weisman's speculative science book, The World Without Us. Weisman told Steve Paulson that it wouldn't take long for water to reclaim parts of New York City.
The New York subway system is kind of the underbelly of the city, and when it starts to go, it starts to drag down a lot of things with it. Think of what the island looked like before there was anybody there. It was a forest and it was kind of hilly. The name Manhattan refers to the hills and the rivers and streams that ran between those hills. When the hills were smashed down to superimpose a city grid on top of it, those rivers got buried. So the subway personnel who took me underneath the city showed me that even on a sunny day, they have to pump away about 13 million gallons of groundwater. And if they weren't there maintaining nearly 800 pumps, it's pumping stuff uphill because they are below the water table, the subways would fill within 2 or 3 days. And if there were no one to run emergency pumps, which is what happens now after they have a big rainstorm, within a couple of decades, the columns that are holding up the streets would start to rust, they would start to corrode, they would start to collapse, and the streets would start to cave in, and suddenly there's rivers out there on the surface again.
So New York City itself would actually be quite vulnerable.
Any city would be quite vulnerable. Plants will invade whenever we are not looking. If no one were maintaining the streets, first of all, the sewers would all clog because all these plastic bags that are blowing around, no maintenance people picking them up. No one's raking the leaves. The leaves will fill the streets. Seeds will blow around. They will germinate in the leaf mulch. And then without any firemen, lightning strike will cause a fire, and that will add carbon and nutrients as paper and insulation in the buildings burn. And then the rusting reinforcing bar or girders will start to expand, pop off concrete. That'll add some nice lime to the soil, so the soil will be less acidic. And within a few centuries, we'll have nice mature forests growing among the ruins of our cities.
But realistically, if all of humanity was going to get wiped out, wouldn't a lot of other stuff get wiped out in the process if you're talking about nuclear explosion or something like that?
But I'm not talking about those
I know
things.
You're not. So, yeah. But I mean, it raises the specter of, so what, some virus that might totally wiped out humans, but basically nothing else?
Exactly. Well, here's a good example. AIDS is a virus that only attacks human beings right now. Certain primates carry it, but they are not affected by it. Suppose it were airborne as opposed to, you know, passed by fluids. Suppose bird flu, you know, suddenly really, you know, mutated in a way that we were the primary victims. You know, I dispense with the possibilities within about a paragraph or so. What I'm really interested in is clearing the decks of human beings and all of our distractions so we can see more clearly what else is here, how it would get along without us constantly heaping more stress on it all the time, and also how would it deal with all the stuff we would leave behind, and not just our infrastructure, but all the carbon that we've pumped up, smokestacks, our radioactive waste, plastics. But ultimately, the reason for writing this book is for us to see it without us enough so we could see how beautifully nature could and would heal. It has before, after previous extinctions. And then say, yeah, but it's so lovely. Isn't there a way that we could still be a part of this? That's what the book is really about, figuring out what our proper relationship is with nature and how we might achieve that again.
You did a lot of traveling as you were researching this book. What were some of the most interesting places you went?
Well, the Korean Demilitarized Zone certainly stands out. For a writer, it's like walking into a living metaphor. You've got this 2.5-mile-wide strip that bisects the Korean Peninsula since 1953, when the truce was, suspended the Korean War. But you've got two of the world's biggest and most ferocious armies facing each other. I mean, they're in plain sight. They can see each other. Their guns are pointed at each other. They scream at each other through loudspeakers. And yet this strip of land in between has accidentally, no one planned this, reverted into a wilderness that is now one of the most important wildlife refuges in all of Asia. And some of the most precious endangered species take shelter there.
What are some of the animals that are there?
Well, there's the Amur leopard, the one that is most special to me, because I get to see this it looked like a squadron of military planes in the distance. And then suddenly, in the midst of all these, you know, seething hostilities, this flock of red-crowned cranes, which after the whooping crane is the rarest crane on Earth. And they settle in silently in the midst of all of this stuff. And you know, this is a bird that we've all seen because it's depicted in all Oriental art. You know, this cherry cap and black extremities, and the rest of it is as pure as white can possibly be. And they feed down there, and I saw young red-crowned cranes. They are reproducing, and it's just a magnificent sight. And this is why scientists, including the foundation here in Wisconsin, are trying to convince the two Koreas what a wonderful thing it would be for the world and to bring them closer to each other by making it an international peace park, which I hope happens, because if not, all the suburban development of Seoul, Korea is going to pour in there, or the industrial parks of North Korea. I mean, that's the scenario if the two Koreas unite. That's not so beautiful. Mm-hmm. Or, of course, if there were nobody left on Earth, then all the peninsula would be a peace park.
Yeah. Now, you also went to a vast primeval forest that I'd never heard about. I guess it's between Poland and Belarus.
Yeah. My book starts there. It, you know, just like the authors of Genesis take people back to the Garden of Eden, you know, to paradise, so we can kind of remember our roots. I go to this forest, which is the last remaining fragment of wilderness in Europe. It was preserved by a Lithuanian duke who married the Queen of Poland in the 14th century as a royal hunting preserve. It's about 500,000 acres. And after him, a series of Polish kings and then Russian czars and then eventually all the way up through the Nazis, because Hermann Göring was a big nature fanatic, they kept it as sort of a private little domain. And then it became a national park after World War II. You go in there and you see a lot of the trees that we are accustomed to seeing here, you know, in the northern part of the northern hemisphere. You see this temperate forest, you see these oaks and you see these pines and you see these alders and ash trees, but you have never seen such gigantic versions of them. This is the forest you'd see in your mind's eye when you read Grimm's fairy tales when you're a kid. The interesting thing is, though, it doesn't seem exotic the way the Amazon seems exotic. It seems right, like your body remembers, oh yes, this is the way nature's supposed to be. We were bred to kind of a pale copy, you know, the second growth version of these majestic huge forests. And I really hope that my book is read by everyone in Europe, and fortunately it's coming out in all those European languages now, so they realize what a treasure they have before the governments of Poland and Belarus keep picking away at it as they've already started, you know, forest managers, professionals, telling nature how it can do it.
Now, I know you didn't write this book to give us morals, but maybe we should have fewer children.
Well, one of the reasons that this book, I think, has received so much attention, and it's very well received because it doesn't preach, it just puts facts out there. At the very end of the book, I do bring up one fact that we have to consider, and as readers have said, you know, this is something I would not have wanted to follow if it was early in the book, but at the end it's so obvious, and that is that every 4 days there's a million more of us on the planet. So I do another thought experiment at the end of the book. It's not something that I'm very comfortable with. I don't think any one of us would be comfortable with this notion. But the experiment is, instead of imagining suddenly a world where there are no human beings, let's imagine a world where human beings get to stay. But instead, each time, each family that procreates only does it once. You know, every woman only has one child. What would happen? Well, it took me a while to find someone to run the numbers. The zero population growth movement is gone in the United States for political reasons. They changed their name to something else, but it's not very recognizable, frankly. And in Europe, I found demographic institutes, though, that were very interested in this question. It turns out that at the end of the 19th century, there were 1.6 billion people on the planet. At the end of the 20th century, 6.6 billion people on the planet. We're headed to 9 billion people. If we reduced our procreation and there were only one child per family, within a century, we'd go back to 1.6 billion people. We're going to have to do some things in order to survive, and we're going to have to make some hard decisions, and I think the population issue has to be on the table. So that's the one thing that I raise in this book. Everybody else is talking about all the different ways we should be recycling and we should be using energy more efficiently. I've written about that previously. This book basically was to let us see how beautiful our planet would be from the perspective of us not being in the way, and then figure out, you know, what could we do that might let us stay here.
You mentioned the atmosphere. What about climate, global climate? How would that change if humans disappeared?
If we stopped sending carbon up the smokestack tomorrow, no more exhaust pipes. According to the atmospheric scientists that I've talked to, it'd probably take about 100,000 years for all the carbon that we have dug out of the ground, you know, that energy that nature didn't need anymore, so nature buried it. The energy in the exhaust is now packed the atmosphere with more carbon dioxide than this planet has seen since nearly 700,000 years ago, and things were a lot more tropical around here. The 100,000 years that it would take for it to be reabsorbed by the oceans, by the biological systems, by actually the geology itself, most of it would really occur during the first 1,000 years. Turnovers of the ocean would help absorb an awful lot of carbon dioxide. And so within the first few 100 years, you'd start to see a noticeable difference, I guess. I mean, you know, we're starting to notice that plant regimes are changing, that we have longer growing seasons than we used to have. But it's hard to say. You know, there are many different models for what this means because of the amount of carbon we've put into the atmosphere. The future is kind of a moving target. So at a certain point in the book where I talk about different scenarios of climate change, I have to give a few different options. A warmer New York, for example, that forest that comes back might not be the one that Henry Hudson saw. It might be have palmettos and magnolias. Could it be that all that warming will melt the Greenland ice cap to the point that it'll dump enough cold fresh water to slow down the ocean or stop the ocean conveyor? Will we have some kind of ice age or freeze in Europe and east coast of the United States? If so, then maybe we'll have a tundra. Could those things possibly cancel each other out? There are even some models that look at that possibility, in which case maybe we will continue to have oaks and beeches and some of the trees that we are familiar with. Every year, of course, has been surprising recently.
Alan Wiseman is a journalist from Massachusetts. He's the author of The World Without Us. Steve Paulson spoke with him.